Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Fantasy, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. This is your host, Gabrielle Matthew. Today I'll be talking with Ava Reed, the author of The Wolf and the Woodsman, a fast-paced debut fantasy novel based on Eastern European folklore. Here is my review. The wolf, in the title, refers to a pagan woman given to the dreaded woodsman to keep her village safe. Evike is part of a tithe sent to satisfy the king, who demands a quota of witches every year. The impoverished villages hidden in the woods are inhabited by women with magical powers who worship the old gods. The woodsmen, the king's religious paramilitary order, bring selected women to the capital, where their eventual fates are a mystery, but surely not good. Evike, the metaphorical wolf of the story, is an illiterate, angry young woman who's been taunted by the villagers. She's also not a witch. She's clad in a witch's wolf pelt, sent with the woodsmen so that the true witches can remain safe to guard the village. When misfortune besets her guards, and only the one-eyed Gaspar remains to guard her, she learns that neither she or he are who they appear to be. The trials of their journey reveal latent magic in her and lay bare his misery as the less favored son of the king. Though Gaspar's piety and rigidity infuriate her, she finds herself drawn to him both physically and emotionally. As Evike journeys to the north and then to her country's capital, meeting her estranged father and eventually the king himself, she learns that the world is a complex place with much more at stake than she ever realized. So to introduce the book, I'm going to let Ava read a little bit herself, and then we'll start off on the interview.
The trees have to be tied down by sunset. When the woodsmen come, they always try to run. The girls who are skilled forgers fashion little iron stakes to drive through the roots of the trees and into the earth, anchoring them in place. With no gift for forging between the two of us, Boroka and I haul a great length of rope, snaring any trees we pass in clumsy loops and awkward knots. When we finish, it looks like the spiderweb of some giant creature, something the woods might cough up. The thought doesn't even make me shiver. Nothing that might break through the tree line could be worse than the woodsman. "Who do you think it will be?" Boroka asks. The light of the setting sun filters through the patchy cathedral of tree cover, dabbling her face. Tears are pearled in the corners of her eyes. "Virag," I say, "with any luck." Boroka's mouth twists. Though I suspect halfway through their journey, the woodsman will tire of her babbling about weather omens and dump her in the Black Lake. "You don't mean that." "Of course I don't. I wouldn't wish the woodsman on anyone, no matter how much they lashed me, how meanly they chided me, or how many hours I spent scraping their cold guyash out of yesterday's pots. But it's easier to loathe Virag than to worry I might lose her."
Hi, Ava, and thanks for doing that reading for us. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I'll jump right into the questions, and we're going to start off with the heroine of your story, Evike. She has three important possessions. She has very little, but she has these things.
a wolf robe, and in that she carries in her pockets a braid of hair and a gold coin. Can you explain the value of each item for your readers?
Yeah. So the wolf cloak is something that is really forced upon her. It's not something that she really considers truly her own. I think it's a comfort to some degree because it reminds her of home, but it's also, you know, she describes it as being heavy and burdensome because it's a reminder of this sacrifice she's been forced to make. And it's a reminder of what she can never have, you know, the acceptance of her village, that sense of belonging, and the power that the white cloak represents. So the braid of hair is her mother's, was given to her by her mother before her mother was taken by the woodsman. So that kind of symbolizes her grief and the very, very personal vendetta that she holds against the woodsman. It's kind of this more intimate, personal loathing that, you know, the other girls in her village might not experience to the same degree. And the gold coin belongs to her father. And her father is a man that she's never met, and his bloodline, you know, his heritage has, she sees, has cursed her to this powerless and marginalized life. So it's symbolic of kind of both the longing that she feels for a sense of community that she, you know, believes she could potentially have, you know, with her father and her father's people. But it also, you know, carries with it that resentment that she feels towards him because she thinks that he's abandoned her. And I think, you know, eventually the coin is something that importantly serves as a point of connection between her and Gashvar, because both of them are outcasts whose bloodlines have relegated them to, you know, quite miserable existences.
Mm-hmm. So Eva Kay starts off the novel with very little. None of the possessions we've just mentioned truly belong to her. And even her magic, here's a little bit of a spoiler, she does eventually get some, but it's bestowed by a god to be taken if she offends him. What does she have that is completely her own, and how does it serve her in the end?
So I would say that Eva Kay actually has several things that belong to her and her alone in the end. And one is, you know, her archery, which is a talent that she cultivated and earned on her own as some way to buy herself, you know, the measure of acceptance in her village. And this is something, obviously, you know, without spoilers, but comes in very handy in the end.
That's just what I was thinking.
Yeah, she also has something else in the end, which is the ability to read and write, which no one else in her village has. You know, she learns to spell her own name. She learns that she can to write down the stories that have been told to her so many times. And that's a way for her to kind of indelibly say, you know, I was here, I mattered, what I did made a difference. And you know, nothing can take that away from her in the end.
And words are very powerful in your novel, as will be revealed in the latter third of it. They have an innate power. So that's a very good point about her learning how to read and write. She also develops a measure of compassion. And I think that starts off with her statement that a bad memory shared between two people carries with it only half the pain. She states that several times in the narrative. How does this belief influence her interactions with several important people in a novel?
I think that, you know, Eva is fundamentally a very lonely person at the outset. She only has one real friend, and that friend is someone who doesn't necessarily understand or relate to her, you know, and I think this line really speaks to her longing for, you know, exactly that, someone who does understand her. And there's this particular moment where she's like trying to get under Gashvar's skin,
And she basically says, like, oh, so you do think we're alike after all. And she's just kind of teasing in there, but there's a real desire underneath that, I think, that she's drawn to him because she finally sees someone who's like her, someone who understands that kind of pain the way that she does.
Yeah, it's a real enemies to lovers component in the story that a lot of people like. Eva K is very lonely. She's her only mother figure, as it were, is a very grumpy old woman, V-Rag. V-Rag often beats her, but she does tell her stories. So would you say that Eva K has a bond with V-Rag? And if so, what is the predominant emotion there?
So I think that Eva K's relationship with V-Rag is much more significant than even she gives it credit for, because it's foundational to the view she has of the world and of herself, that you can't trust the people who are supposed to care for you, that the world is a fundamentally unforgiving place, and you need to protect yourself from it by any means necessary. But by the end of the book, though, you know, Eva K does come to the conclusion that she loves V-Rag and V-Rag loves her. And that's because she's learned over the course of the book that you can still love someone who causes you pain. And the pain is, in some ways, integral to the experience of love. You know, and she says it's not the same kind of love that she feels for Gashbar, for her father. But by the end, she's not so afraid anymore. She's not so afraid of feeling pain. That she understands that you can hold, you know, pain and affection at the same time. And one doesn't necessarily cancel out the other.
Speaking of pain, scarring and disfigurement come up often in your novel. And I found it interesting. There seems to be a difference between making a decision to scar yourself or having someone else scar you.
Yeah, so disfigurement is like a really common fantasy trope, though you most often see it used in this very like ableist sense to convey like the evilness or the wretchedness of a character. And, you know, I'm a person who has significant scarring and a disfigurement, but, you know, they're not, you know, immediately legible the way that Gashbar's are. I wanted to, you know, interrogate and invert this trope a little bit. So Gashbar and the other woodsmen, obviously, they scar themselves, they disfigure themselves in order to gain power. And initially, Eva K doesn't see any kind of difference between someone hurting you and you hurting yourself, which is why she's so baffled that Gashbar would do this. You know, again, because she lives in a world where any sign of pain is a weakness that will be taken advantage of. So she's sort of like, why on earth would you inflict pain on yourself when the world is already out there doing it to you, you know? It just completely, you know, baffles her. But Gashbar and the other woodsmen, they recognize a difference between self-harm and harm done by others. You know, Gashbar says that losing his eye actually, you know, spoiler, doesn't confer him any kind of magic because it was taken from him by force and it wasn't, you know, a sacrifice willingly given. And sacrifice, you know, in the form of flesh specifically is fundamental to the belief system of the woodsman, to the belief system of the Kasha faith in general. But I think in the end, Eva K kind of concludes that for Gashbar, the self-harm is just external pain turned inward. You know, he has no other way to cope, to gain acceptance, to gain power, you know, love for the people who hate him except by, you know, by scarring himself. I think that's a pretty, you know, universal narrative about self-harm that's, you know, resonant in contemporary society, too.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
All the scarring was a sign of bravery in a lot of so-called primitive cultures. The ability to withstand pain, to not let pain intimidate you, to not be frightened of pain. I'm thinking of American Indian rituals that they had. So yeah, it's interesting. There definitely is a difference between choosing to pain yourself for a greater goal or passively being unable to protect yourself when someone else is scarring you. So
yeah,
Evika and Gasper get to know more and more about each other. They have to rely on each other to survive, and they begin to trust each other, and attraction grows between them. We really only know Gasper as he's described through Evikai. Evikai is a better fighter. She's sexually frank. She often chastises Gaspar for being ashamed of his lust. Do you think traditional gender roles are a little reversed in this story?
So I really like this question because Evike goes between two extremely rigidly gendered worlds. You know, she grows up in a matriarchal society in her home village, and then she enters the patriarchal society of the Patropheus and, you know, the larger kingdom. And she doesn't really belong in either of them because in her village, you know, she's alienated from her, you know, alleged gender by virtue of her bloodline. You know, she talks about how she doesn't participate in, you know, the normal activities of women around the village. You know, she kind of goes off with the men. She kind of exists in this kind of interstitial place. And then in the larger world, you know, she's seen as this pagan, you know, barbarian before she's seen, you know, as a woman. And in a sense, I think that, yes, it is a reversal of gender roles and that EVK is more, you know, openly sexual, but I don't know if I was, like, necessarily thinking of that specifically when I was writing the book. You know, EVK, she's more bald about her desires because she was raised in a non-monogamous culture. You know, they don't have a traditional family structure. So there's no shame, you know, associated with sex. She's more ashamed of, you know, feeling a real emotional attachment to Gaspar, you know, because he's her enemy. Whereas Gaspar was raised in a culture that practices, you know, strict monogamy, and he's, you know, in this holy order where chastity is a requirement. So his sexual desires are just, you know, they're another reminder to him that he's failed in performing the role that's been expected of him. So I think, like, yes, it is definitely like a reversal of gender roles, but it's also about two characters who just, you know, fail at performing gender the way that they're supposed to.
Yeah, Gaspar does come from the dominant culture of the land, which practices patri faith and worships the Principatrius. I liked that. Amanatheistic deity. And so there's lots of rules in that culture. Cultures that worship different gods are marginalized and maligned by those who practice the patri faith. For instance, the pagan women of the village, as you said, they're looked on as barbarians and they're judged and mistrusted for their magic. However, what's interesting is The woodsmen actually also have powers that come from serving their god and sacrificing their flesh. So even though their adherence of this rigid anti-magical religion, they still practice magic to me. And so I wonder what kind of distinction they make mentally. How do they make that palatable among themselves that they also use magic powers? And how do they justify it?
Yeah, this is, one of the, I think, kind of fundamental. This is kind of one of the first ideas that I have, and the rest of the book kind of spawned from that, because this is fundamentally, a book about faith. And, faith takes many forms. And so to be a good, patrician, you have to perform this unquestioning devotion and readiness to sacrifice yourself in any way that your God sees fit. So power is not your birthright by any means. It's something you have to earn, through self-flagellation and debasement. And it's not, a one-for-one comparison. And I was actually inspired, by as much by Christianity as I was by the cult of Mithras, which is this pre-Christian Roman cult. It's very fascinating.
Okay.
Look it up. Yeah, but I was in this aspect, I was really inspired by the Catholic idea of original sin, where you are essentially born in a state of immorality, and you have to spend your entire life, making up for that,
apologizing.
You have to love God even though God hates you.
That's great.
Yeah, and they call it, the reason that they call it power rather than magic is just, it's rhetorical. They need a way to distinguish between, what they do from what the pagans do, but it's essentially just a semantic difference that's, been created by political powers and political pressures.
That's exactly what it seemed like. It's just like they take control of the narrative and reword it to make this artificial distinction between themselves and cultures they say they despise.
Exactly. Yeah. And you see so many times that what the pagans do and what the patricians and what the woodsmen do are really exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be explicit about that. You don't see Gaspar doing anything. He starts fires, he heals himself. These are all of this, this is the same exact, magic that the people in EBK's village have, but for them, they don't have this kind of, the same idea of original sin or like debasement. So they see it as, very much a birthright. It's something that you're just entitled to by being assigned female birth within the tribe. You have to like train and practice. But there's no physical debasement required. Spoiler alert, at least EBK initially thinks. Though she, she later comes to understand that even pagan magic requires a personal sacrifice. And I decided to make that the case because I think that it speaks to one of the core themes that belonging to a larger group does require some sort of sacrifice, EVK realizes that Virag is, she's okay with giving up the one wolf girl, every year or so because it keeps the village as a whole safe. The woodsmen are okay with, cutting off some of their small body parts because it makes them more powerful. And I'm really not making any kind of value judgment about that. Pain and sacrifice are a necessary part of belonging and even of love. And it can be taken to, extremes and it can be misused and abused, but we all make sacrifices for the good of larger whole and for the people that we care about.
Well, and it just occurred to me symbolically too, like if there was power in cutting off an appendage, like a finger or something, to belong to a larger group, it also speaks to how we smooth our rough edges so that we don't stand out, and how we might monitor how we speak or how we dress, how that's kind of in a sense, almost the same as cutting off or disavowing a part of ourselves that might extrude too much. That's really interesting what you said, just that clicked for me.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that that's, you know, also shown that EVK is, you know, she's so readily given up because she is different, you know, because she doesn't belong. She's, you know, and EVK does, she makes the kind of symbolic connection between, you know, the king kind of allowing, you know, some pagans to exist because they, you know, imbue him with both, you know, actual and symbolic power, and EVK being given up, you know, in service of that. And all of that is kind of in service of creating, you know, a nation or a culture that is, you know, that is kind of holistic and homogenous, even though we know that that's a fiction, you know, that's a myth.
Yeah, speaking of the king, this is not part of the questions, but shall we tell the readers what his crown is made of, or shall we let them find out for themselves?
Sure, yeah, just, you know, spoiler alert.
His crown is made of fingernails that he's taken from those with magical powers. But that's all I'm going to say. So you've delved into Hungarian and Jewish folktales to enrich your world. I noticed there's a recurring motif about creatures that appear harmless but are actually very dangerous. They're black chickens, a nude young girl wandering the woods, and a kindly old woman stirring stew. Each of those are revealed as creatures or monsters with ravenous appetites. What function do you think these types of folk tales served?
Yeah, well, EVK does, you know, she says that she thinks that the only creatures who have managed to survive this kind of purging of the kingdom are the ones who have been able to use deception, you know, to kind of hide their true form. And I think there's a lot about deception and disguise writ large, and it's actually something the whole plot hinges upon. You know, EVK conceals her identity, you know, as she passes herself off as a seer, but she also, you know, conceals her, you know, Yuhuli heritage, you know, the form of survival. Gashbar, you know, for a short time conceals his identity from her, but he also, you know, does his best to conceal, you know, his parentage and his, you know, bloodline for his survival. And, you know, for both of them, the survival completely depends on appearing as something that they're very much not. And I really did want from the beginning, you know, this world and its folklore and its fairy tales to be, you know, kind of, you know, secretly dangerous, because I think in a meta sense, they are, you know, there's this really ugly underbelly to pretty much every European fairy tale you can think of.
Yes,
know.
There are.
Whether it's like, you know, the anti-Semitism in Rumpelstiltskin, or, you know, the cautionary tale about pedophilia in Little Red Riding Hood, or, you know, the parables of like familial domestic abuse in the Juniper Tree. There's something, you know, festering under the surface of all of these stories. You know, these fairy tales, they have, you know, figurative and literal teeth.
To me, those stories just speak of a deep distrust of the other, that, this may look harmless, but who knows? And that distrust is also, of course, in your novel, the predominant culture has that distrust of anyone, any other culture that's different, such as the Yehuli, who are often persecuted and blamed for anything that goes wrong.
Yeah, definitely. And that's, you know, that's self-protective, because this is a country that is very much defining itself. So they're very insecure and protective over these narratives that are still being shaped about their own country, you know. So anything that kind of appears to threaten that is, you know, something that needs to be stamped out immediately, you know, because they are very much in the process of nation building, and that's, you know, very delicate and challenging and, you know, up for contestation, you know.
Yeah, that was a focus of your studies at Brandeis, wasn't it? The nation
at Barnard,
Barnard, sorry. Just thinking back about, well, how do people find out a little more about you and which college you went to, which I had wrong. Yeah. What's a good way to follow you on social media?
So I'm most, active on Instagram, and it's at Ava F. Reed. And my Twitter, which I use very sporadically, is at A. Simone Reed. I also have a website, avasreed.com, which I should be better about updating. I think that's all the social media that I kind of regularly use.
Okay, so if you're not updating your website, why don't you tell us what you're working on these days then?
So, I have a second book with Harbor Voyager that's slated for next summer, and mm-hmm. I mentioned the Juniper Tree, and this is actually, this is actually a retelling of the Juniper Tree, but it's set in Victorian era Odessa, Ukraine. And that's actually a good portion of my family actually immigrated from Odessa in that time period. So mm-hmm. it's been kind of fun to repurpose these apocryphal family stories and to do more research about that time period and the people who live there. And if you don't know the Juniper Tree, only look it up if you have a very strong stomach. It's considered the darkest, Grimm's fairy tale. So it's not very well known for that reason, but I think it's absolutely fascinating.
Eva's novels does have quite a following, but it is, just for anyone who's listening, it's not really intended to be a YA novel.
That's definitely important to remember. There's a lot of I constantly see reviews reminding people, just so you know, this is not YA. There's a lot of, there's gore, there's body horror, mm-hmm. obviously, mm-hmm. Themes of ethnic cleansing and genocide. tread lightly.
Well, thanks so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk with us.
Of course, this was great.
Thanks for listening to me today on the New Books Network in Fantasy. I've been talking to Eva Reed about her debut novel, The Wolf and the Woodsman. Next up next month will be my interview with P. J. Lee Clark for his novel, A Master of Gin, which takes place in an alternate steampunk Cairo. I'm your host, Gabrielle Matthew. You can also follow me on Twitter to get updates about new podcasts and more, at Gabrielle Author, GABRIELLEAUTHOR. Till next time.